Blog Talk Radio.
All right.
Yeah. You guys want to start the show?
Let's start the show.
In the great hall of the Justice League.
Find the sugar. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Saturday Morning Serial. It's that one podcast you listen to every now and then when we put it out that discusses, explores, and celebrates all the themes of Saturday morning TV that we grew up with. And hey, wouldn't you just know it? Damn themes, they've been growing up right alongside us. It's me, Dan Grimshay, by the way. I'm the one talking at you. You can't shut me down. If you want to, feel free to tune out these gentlemen, starting first with our good buddy, Marquis. Marquis, speak up. Hello there. Doing a little Star Wars foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it wouldn't be complete with at least Jimmy the Gentle Aziski sitting in the passenger back seat. Jimmy, get loud.
It's me, Jimmy.
There he is. So today is a Star Wars day.
It's Star Wars.
It's even May 4th, wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you know, I feel like we've never mentioned Star Wars for some reason across almost 10 years of this show. Why not bring it up now? We got a couple of good guests, especially
huge
to those of you who use your ears to consume. We've got Matthew Wood, first of all. Also, you've seen him on screen. Even if you don't know his name, you have heard his work and even his voice. Maybe I won't spoil it. We're going to talk to him later. I'm not saying anything more about him right now. But
everybody
sure.
knows. Everyone knows who Matthew Wood is.
Yeah. I'm dumb for trying.
Guarantee it. Go on.
I'm sorry. But also we have Joseph Shirley is his name. First person to make a joke gets muted. He is a composer, so he's obviously another audio guy.
Boy,
you can't be
thing.
We're doing an audio.
You can't be serious.
No. And Jimmy shut down for 30 seconds.
We need a classic Matthew Wood sound effect of like a droid.
He's in the Shirley corner.
Oh, surely he should be. Anyway, Joseph Shirley, composer from, he's done a couple of things. Marky, help me out. Where can we find him?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the guy, he's fresh off of a hit movie called Creed 3, but he's also in the Star Wars world. He's done Book of Boba Fett. He's done he did the most recent season of the Mandalorian. So we're going to talk about his role as composer because it's a little, you have to kind of organize what this means to be a composer. So hold on, wait till that audio comes. It'll make a lot more sense.
It will. But in the meantime, I don't know, let's dick around a little bit. What else is big in Star Wars news these days? Because I don't know about you guys. Well, actually, I do know about you guys, but I quickly chewed through the new Mandalorian season. Mm-hmm. I understand it's gotten some mixed reviews. I thought it was great.
Yeah, well, you're not going to hear a complaint from me. But, Jimmy, what did you think?
I loved it. I thought it was really good. I think it's I like that show better than the prequels or the sequels outside of the original trilogy. Well, Rogue One was pretty good. But that's kind of my wheelhouse for Star Wars, that sort of storytelling, those characters, that, I guess, that time period in the Star Wars universe, right? I really enjoyed it. A couple of those cameos, you could even debate if they are cameos at all. But
we don't.
they were a little over the top for me. But other than that, I mean, you know, overall, I give it 9.5 out of 10.
that's a great
risk. Good. And because you can't put something out on the internet without, you know, at least trying to shit somewhere on it, I'll go with Jimmy. I'll chase down that 0.5 star that he didn't give it. And these cameos, there was that one, to me, it was a weak link in the season, that one diversionary fetch quest episode.
Yeah.
It was still good TV. Don't get me wrong. But I feel like this is one of those rare shows that I watch every week the day it comes out, if I can. Usually I wait for stuff to pile up and then I binge that mother. So if I was binging it like I normally do, it probably wouldn't have bothered me so much. But I'm looking forward a whole week being like, all right, where does this adventure take us? And immediately, just like in a video game, when you enter like a new section of the open world, you get pulled off to do a fetch quest right away.
Yeah, well, both
like, oh, yeah, we'll take you to see who you need, but first you got to do us this favor and go track down this unrelated story arc.
Almost every series has, like, into last episode, and I'm talking about modern streaming series these days within the last 5-7 years, has that the second to last episode is either a flashback or it explains everything or it's a throwaway or it's like this particular episode was just, like, for fun, I guess. But even though that was my least favorite episode, I'm talking about Jack Black and Lizzo's appearances. Even though that was my least favorite episode of the season, of this season, it was still a lot of fun. There's still some cool stuff that happened. There was, you know, I still enjoyed it. I just thought, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah. I binge it again later, it won't bother me nearly as much because I know we're back on track afterwards, so I can take a breather. So I get that pacing, but a week-to-week show, man, you better deliver.
Well, here, I'm like in that scene of the Schwarzenegger movie, Commando. I'm like strapping up. Tying the grenades to my vest. I'm putting the camouflage across. I'm ready to defend that episode because I thought it was great. I think I loved the, like, Law and Order kind of aspect of it where they really, really, really leaned into that Law and Order part because you had the partner, you had the kind of, you know, the real kind of gruffy kind of older partner, which was the Bo-Katan Kryze. Then you had the young kind of hotshot just ready to kind of tangle with those droids, Mandalorian. And they go and they, you know, they end up going through all of these guest appearances, not cameos, but guest appearances from Jack Black and from Lizzo. And from Christopher Lloyd, not Christopher Lloyd.
Just so you're aware, in the final show, there will be an edited-in editor's note about how you're wrong, but continue.
So they end up going through all of these guest appearances, performed wonderfully. And, of course, it ends up being the biggest guest star of them all, right? I mean, of course, that's who's guilty because that's how a Law & Order episode is. So beside the kind of meta, kind of pop culture kind of joke that it was, I loved that. I loved all that story building about the droids, you know, and about how they're kind of itching for kind of rights and for kind of purpose and for meaning to not be discarded. And I think that's world building. And I think Star Wars is very important to Star Wars is to build that world. You know, more specifically to build that universe. But, you know, I think it's really important. And it was a fun episode. It was a great episode. It was great action. And it did have a little something to do with the end because they end up, you know, meeting up with Axe Wolves, which gives them the fleet, which, you know, allows them to kind of get into Mandalore. And,
you know, as soon as they met up with Axe Wolves, it was they had done the fetch quest. That is what the episode should have started with, is my argument.
That is why they went to that planet, was to meet with him. But anyway, yeah.
And,
anyway, like, let's
first they had dinner with Lizzo and Jack Black first.
in brilliant cameos. Loved him.
Not a cameo.
Loved every bit of it.
Just a guest role, not a cameo.
Mm-hmm.
But to move past that and to move into like the grander kind of discussion that's out there right now.
I think you're right. We should talk to Matthew Wood.
Well, hold on. Hold on.
Matthew Wood. Who's that? Surely we're not listening to that interview first.
Shirley's later. Wood is now. But hold on. Hold on real quick because we just had a Mandalorian war. Jetpacks, aerial assaults, Star Destroyers crashing, a force-yielding, quote, Baby Yoda saving the day without attacking anybody, all force and smarts and bravery. Like, we had a Darksaber, we had a Mandalorian supervillain played by Gus Fring. Like, we had just an incredible, incredible season and battle and war.
Sounds like Marquis had to take a nap afterwards.
It was an incredible.
Yeah, it was. And spectacle beyond even cinema.
Beyond.
Kind of. And it didn't feel like there was a wasted second, aside from all the ones I mentioned, in the storytelling.
But not one cameo.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and listen to a chat with Star Wars, not pioneer, but current torch holder. The man in charge of the sound lexicon, you know, what you are allowed, what things in any Star Wars property should sound like, have to get his okay. So, you know, damn it, he's a big deal. Hey, Magic Interview Machine, let's hear from Matthew Wood.
Meanwhile,
I guess, what's your origin story? How did you get from an entry-level position to sitting in Ben Burtt's seat? Was that a quick, were you anointed?
Anointed. I think, I got that job at Lucasfilm very young. I was still in high school. I was a video games tester. So, and then I just persisted. I said, I got over imposter syndrome maybe about maybe 2 years ago. No, I'm kidding. I've been there about 32 years. This amazing opportunity came about for me to be able to test video games for a company that was in Nicasio, California. And I grew up in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area. So I did some research. I was, working at the county library, and I did some research about what kind of companies were in Nicasio. And I looked it up, and it was either going to be like some kind of agricultural dairy farm or likely Lucasfilm. And in those days, Lucasfilm was a hidden place. You couldn't find Skywalker Ranch, there was no way to Google it. And it was this very hidden place. So I faxed a resume over to them. My father had a fax machine for some of the business he was doing at the time in 1989. And I was able to get my resume to the top of the pile because they said that no one ever faxed a resume to them before. And so I got an interview, and I was able to kind of, hit it off with one of my colleagues there. And I ended up becoming a tester for some really early video games at LucasArts, The Secret of Monkey Island and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Loom and Secret Weapons of Luftwaffe. And so I ended up having a really great time working out there. I was a gamer myself. I still am. So being able to test video games for a job was just, I couldn't even believe that was an actual profession. And I made some great connections. And luckily I had a recommendation when there was an opening that happened at Skywalker Ranch at Skywalker Sound. George Lucas was putting together a post-production sort of way that he wanted to do the new prequel movies. And he was doing a lot of R&D inside the company itself and doing a program called SoundDroid and another one called EditDroid. And I got asked to be part of the SoundDroid development team to kind of test their program. So they went and got a tester from their games division because the suggestion was get one of those kids from games to come in and hammer on our program and see if he can break it. And we started working on the Young Indiana Jones TV series back then for George, and that was sort of our precursor to get ready to do more movies, more Star Wars films in the 90s.
I don't remember a lot of droid sounds in that old show.
Yeah. Not in Young Indy. It's funny because that I do acting as well. You know, that's something I've always loved, and I've always been in theater as a kid and American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. And I've done, community college theater and all that when I was younger. And I got a lot of opportunities from George to put my voice into Young Indiana Jones. It was always like, we need somebody here to do this and that, this peasant in this scene or this guy that's fighting in that scene. And so I got a lot of practice doing that with him, because one of the great things about working with George and Ben Burtt was that they were just open to just being able to do not just your, job that you had to do. They were open to, if you had suggestions about other things or wanted to participate in some other role, they were very open to that. And it was an independently minded company. And sort of the buck stopped with George, and I got to be part of that core team on working and developing a procedure in a way that we would do the prequel movies. And that went on for a long time.
So Gordon Wright from teenage game tester to, playing Bib Fortuna.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see the through line there.
That was a funny story, because I was working, that was on Phantom Menace. And at that point, that was my first big supervising job I was doing with Ben Burtt. I always idolized Ben. I was one of the first people I met when I started at Skywalker Ranch. And he was taking a break and doing a lot of directorial stuff for IMAX. And but he was going to come back to do the prequel movie and the prequel movies. And it was right around the time that digital technology was changing for filmmaking, and I got in, really early being part of that development team. And so I was able to teach him some of the new ways of doing sound, and he was able to teach me the aesthetics of sound design and what it's like to work with a team and his sort of approach to how he created the Star Wars sound, universe. And so I got that amazing lesson from him, and it created a lifelong relationship together on film. And he's just a great mentor and a wonderful person that still works at Skywalker, and I'm forever grateful for him. Yeah.
So the two of you essentially wrote the probably chiefly him, so no offense to you, but
no.
Wrote the sound style guide.
Totally. And the one thing that was amazing about working on the Star Wars films is that George Lucas himself really considered sound a major player in making the movies. We have John Williams, obviously, incredible soundscape that he had created musically. And then sound, George gave a lot of time and budget and effort to. So we would start a year, sometimes more than a year before the shooting even began, to start acquiring sound effects and going out and recording animals and machines and explosions and artillery and soundscapes and wind and all that, to just come and have a great new palette of things to work with to create these worlds. And that's something he did on the original Star Wars films. That's how Ben Burtt had all that time to create all those incredible sounds of R2-D2 and the lightsabers and TIE fighters and Chewbacca and droids and the Millennium Falcon. And he was given time and budget to do that by George, and then he created this amazing soundscape that I think it was kind of unprecedented at the time. And I think he even got one of the first special sound awards for as an Oscar for that film.
Oh, well deserved. That's a huge part of our lexicon, our cultural zeitgeist lexicon, whatever Star Wars sounds.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when I saw Star Wars in the theater, not The New Hope, right? So I'm old enough to remember that first press push where a lot of the focus was on how they did that, like how they got the lightsaber noises, how they recorded the sound for the blasters and everything. So you keep referring to him as Mr. Lucas as George. So can I assume that you've got a very close relationship with him? Do you have a great anecdote that maybe you could share with us about hanging out with
George?
George
is the most down to earth, average everyday billionaire you'll ever meet. I mean, he's just completely. I never felt like I mean, Star Wars obviously is something bigger than all of us. And that's one thing that we all kind of felt is when we're working on this project, it was a group of folks coming together from all different backgrounds and become it, almost like it is in the movie. It's how, you know, like the storytelling of people coming together and under some sort of duress, and then they have to achieve something. That's kind of what we felt like working on the films with George. And you know, we never really had, there wasn't drama created just for the sake of drama. There wasn't a lot of overtime done there. You know, George valued family and personal life as much as he valued us doing a good job on the film. So that's why we have this amazing place like Skywalker Ranch that we work at. That's this incredible, one of a kind, high tech sort of movie making empire that's in the middle of beautiful nature in Northern California. I don't think that exists really anywhere in the world. And he didn't have to take his profits from the film and put it into something that was going to benefit his employees like that, but he did. And he's just, I'll, you know, forever be grateful for working with him. And I try to be that bridge now that we're, you know, the intellectual property of Star Wars is now owned by Disney, but we're still at Skywalker Ranch and George is our landlord now. So he owns the physical property of where we work and, you know, we're now working for Disney, but I'm trying to be that bridge to connect, new generations of people coming in that are filmmakers at the Skywalker and to sort of connect to that, the ways working with George specifically, and there's folks like myself and Dave Filoni and other people at Lucasfilm that have that lucky pleasure to be able to work with George directly and be able to pass some of that on to future generations feels really good to be a keeper of that torch.
Well, it's you should be honored. I'm glad to hear you're taking it seriously.
Absolutely.
The fandom has very sharp ears.
Oh yeah, they do.
And you know what, I can't imagine how many hundreds of hours you've spent with some headphones on just listening to raw sounds. Also you are a major performer. So I know you're not afraid of a little spotlight. So I've got a little challenge for you.
Sure.
I would like to hear right off the top of your head, as well as you can do it, your best Wilhelm scream.
Oh gosh. That's so funny. Well, there's two sort of Wilhelm screams that we've used over the years, and one, and there's dogs in here, so hopefully they won't bark, but one of them is the big one is like the high pitched yelp one goes, I gotta get them right here. Hold on. I haven't actually used them in a while. I have a new scream that we've been putting into films in the last sort of 5-10 years.
We'll get to that then.
Yeah. But there's the sort of lower one that's like that. That's the lower one. And then the other one is
that's the classic. Ooh, that was good.
There's two. Yeah. Certainly we put them in a lot of films, but there's another scream that we've been secretly putting in that I'm not able to divulge yet until we have I'd like to get a lot of films under our belt with it, and then maybe it'll come out one day. But it is peripherally connected to Lucasfilm in a way that's very deep and meaningful.
So it does exist in the medium somewhere already by itself.
Yes.
And you have been recycling it. So this is the
challenge. Yeah, the film I'm working on right now, actually, we just put it in on there too, but I won't even divulge the film that I'm working on right now. I'll just have to look at my IMDb later. When it comes out.
Today's episode. Teaser. So Matthew, you've done, your career goes way back to the redoing the Star Wars, the re-release, right? The original trilogy re-release. And as I scroll through IMDb, I see Con Air, The Rock.
Oh, yeah.
Big hits that you worked on. So, and now you have, in addition to all the sound engineering, you do a lot of voices. So you either die a sound engineer or you live long enough to become a voice actor. How do you transition from job to job?
I mean, for me, it was a logical thing just because I loved acting so much, and it just works a different part of my brain. That sort of instantaneous feedback to something you're doing, it's very real and organic and it's on instinct. And so, and as opposed to a lot of the technical work I do. And then a lot of the sound design work I was doing, I would use my voice for various creatures or droids or whatever it is. I never really expected it to go as wide as it did. And certainly working on Star Wars has opened up a lot of doors for me, which I'm forever grateful for. I love doing voice acting. It's one of my favorite things. I'm using the same equipment I use every day to do sound effects work and editorial. One of my favorite parts of the job is I have a group of folks that I work with, my loop troop that's with Terry Douglas, and we have, 15, 20 folks that are really highly motivated voice actors, and we get together and we go through all these movies and projects I'm working on, and we put our voices in various places to, for creatures and droids and, radio voices and crowds and all that kind of stuff, and it's kind of filling in all the sort of spice of the soundtrack that way, and
additional voices.
Yeah, additional voices, and that's one of my favorite.
It happens though when like the two jobs overlap, like when you do General Grievous's voice, you then go in and filter it and process it yourself, or do you feel like trusted to someone else?
Yes, I will go ahead and do that. If it's something like Grievous, I usually do it myself. My colleague, Chris Scarabosio, that I've worked with for 30 plus years, he came up with sort of the way that Grievous was going to sound. That was before I had the role. This is when we were passing it through all these different actors. We probably did 40 or 50 different actors through this process to kind of see which one we liked. And that was towards the end when George hadn't picked one yet, is when I submitted mine anonymously with the last group of actors. And that's the one he picked. So I Jedi mind tricked George Lucas to get the job.
Curiosity, how was it being pitched to the actors? Like, what was the one line? Like, this is what he sounds like.
I mean,
like wheezy.
Yeah, we had a look. Warren Fu had come up with sort of the look of what he was going to look like, and so we had that, and we had some animatics, scenes that we had worked out in video form, like a video sort storyboard. And George would just kind of leave it up to the actor in a way. I mean, you kind of tell him he's a general. He's in charge of a droid army. He's frustrated. He's not really trusting of anybody. He's
got a nasty cough.
Thumbs his nose at the Jedi. The cough part of it was kind of added later. I mean, it was the kind of thing I remember, because when I did the audition for it, I could really practice the lines that I was auditioning for. And then once I got the role, I was like, wow, some of these sentences are a lot longer than the audition sentences were. And because part of that role was really, like, I've been trained in your Jedi arts, and you have to speak like very like this, like the whole time. And so it was like, but long, I expected someone with your reputation to be,
You're really kicking yourself for picking that voice.
I was like, wow, okay, I have to do this like all the time now. But like, I would run out of breath. And there was a couple of sections where I ran out of breath, and George was like, no, that's good. And then coincidentally, George himself had a cough the day that we were recording the part, and my buddy Chris was running the recorder, and George came up to the mic to give me direction. He was about to do this cough, and I kind of looked at Chris like, keep it rolling. And we recorded some of those coughs, and as we processed them through the same processing chain that I used for my voice, I sent those back to him to be able to cut in his picture editing Avid suite. And they ended up peppering some of George's coughs. And then later on, I came in and did a whole bunch more, because he determined he liked that it showcased that the character had a biological weakness, and it wasn't just 100% robotic. There was a cybernetic component that was vulnerable to, obviously when Obi-Wan Kenobi dispatches him halfway through the movie, it's because he opened up his chest cavity and he got to the biological, parts inside of him. So that cough is sort of just illustrate that. It was, all these villains have some form of weakness, just like Darth Vader with his awful lung that goes on. So it was similar to that. Yeah.
That I just remember being so struck with that first time seeing it.
Yeah.
What a genius idea.
Yeah.
Give this frightening robot a cough.
Yeah, very strange. Very strange idea. And that was, all in the mind of George. That's the way it was. He'd come up with these things, and we would carry them out, and there wasn't a lot of discussion or, big committee discussion about things. I mean, he made the movies he wanted to make, and that felt good to be able to serve that for him and see him be happy and feeling like he made the movie that he wanted to make. So that was a good feeling.
And what
you're listening to your Grievous right now, it sounds like a slightly less ethnic Watto.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. There's a lot of things he kind of, I mean, it's funny because once I put some ring modulation on it, I pitch him down a little bit and then I filter it to make it sound like it's coming out of a speaker. So there's a slightly different approach.
Also, I play all those battle droids, all those little, like, you know, look out, Roger, Roger, all those guys.
Wow.
So those have been hilarious over the years. So a lot of scenes in the Clone Wars series that I did with Dave Filoni, I have a lot of scenes with myself where I'm ordering myself around for things. And then, you know, Grievous is down here.
The battle droids are all up here.
So it was a quick way to juxtapose those two kind of ways together. Yeah. They're really fun.
Oh, like two Avery session.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we ask you about Bib Fortuna? You were
sure.
You played him in live action as well as voicing him in Phantom Menace.
I did.
So yeah, kind of like bookending his
family. Yeah, Phantom Menace. He was just there was a cameo there in the pod race where he's with Jabba as Jabba announces the pod race and it's about to start, and I have to kind of wake him up at one point because he dozes off. But that was, we shot that at ILM. And then late 90s. And then that was just a cameo that I didn't really even, it wasn't credited. I didn't really tell anybody about it, but funnily enough, Dave Filoni knew about it. And so when we were going to bring, I was told they were going to bring the timeline was going to exist where he'd be alive after Return of the Jedi and Favreau and Filoni came to me and they were like, we have really big plans for Bib Fortuna. So, you know, get ready. We're bringing it back. And I was like, wow, you know, I thought that was amazing. And I'd get the scripts early for the show because I'm working on it for, I'd read episode one. Okay. Nothing. And episode, you know, two, three. It's like, I've remastered the entire season of Mandalorian, you know, and there was amazing things happening in season two of Mandalorian, like the, you know, Luke coming back and all that. And I get to the last episode, I'm on episode 208 reading the script, and then I get to the very end, and there's just one paragraph that talks about, you know, Bib Fortuna's on the throne, Boba Fett walks in, shoots him, and that's it. And so I was like, is there going to be another flashback? And so I went down to costume fitting, and then I found out what they meant by big plans. Because it was,
that must have taken a while.
It was this huge fat suit. And amazing costume and super well thought out. And it's, you know, 6 hours of makeup or whatever it was to get into the costume and to shoot for a day. But when I got out the set, Jon Favreau and Filoni, they were just cracking up, you know, and I was like, big plan, big plan. And I loved that. That was such a fun day because it was, you know, really, they had done a lot more makeup than I had done. For Phantom Menace, it was kind of in a wide shot, and I had a couple of close-ups and, you know, or closer shots in Book of Boba. And they, you know, I had the full teeth and the contacts and the giant LaCue that were like, you know, they had the huge, and it was just like the costume was amazing. And I really felt like I could embody it and they created Jabba's palace, you know, and it wasn't all done in the volume. It was actually physically made, there. And I just remember thinking, we were shooting the show and I'm sitting in the throne watching, you know, Boba Fett come down the stairs and walk over to me. And I'm trying to appeal to him and some, you know, speaking Hatties. But I just remember thinking like, that's the action figure that I sent away for with Kenner. And the you know, that I thought, you know, George Lucas personally was packing all up the Boba Fetts to send to the kids, you know, in the 80s or late 70s. And my guy's going to come over and he's going to kill me. And it was such a, like, out-of-body moment. I was, you know, all parts of me were really happy at that point to go to act and then be able to. And also Tamara Morrison, I've worked with him for so long and it was fun because he didn't know I was cast as a character. So I kind of was messing with him for a little while before he knew it was me, which was great with the long fingernails and all that. But that's one of those moments where Star Wars is so special. It's just something that is connected to our childhood, a lot of us, to our childhood DNA and to be part of it, to be able to be part of the creation of it. I 100% fortunate to be able to be part of that, because I know if I wasn't creating it, I'd certainly be in the fandom, a real big part of it, just, you know, discussing it with others and going to conventions and having that, you know, world, because it was just meant so much to me growing up as a kid. So it's pretty fun to be able to make it as well.
Yep. Well, yeah. I'm just waiting for my turn to play Bib Fortuna. I didn't work up full circle. Thanks, Mac.
Yeah.
Actually, real quickly, I'm glad you brought up the volume, because before we let you go, I did want to ask you real quick, you know, about, you know, time is marching on, technology's changing, and now ILM has the X Lab.
Yeah.
I've been working with.
Yes. That's really fun.
I don't, you can't even really even call it like a game studio. What, how broad is it? What is the work you're doing with it?
You know, they're sort of an experimental division of the company, which has been making some amazing interactive experiences for people to have in the Star Wars universe. And I've been able to work with some of the, there's an office, a subset at Skywalker Ranch with Kevin Boland, that I've been able to help them just evaluate what they're looking at. Since I'm a gamer, you know, putting on VR and working in all that space is not intimidating to me. I don't get, like, I don't have any kind of motion difficulty with any of it. And the games are so amazing. I don't think I even would if I did, but I also voice act for them in a lot of the projects that they're working on. And then I also cast some of the ancillary talent to come in and do their voice acting for it. But it's been, I love watching the engine in which they create things. It's similar to a gaming engine, but because it is an interactive experience, but it's just watching Star Wars be put into that world and to be able to act in it. That's one thing Lucasfilm's always been great with is using new and experimental technology. That was, I think, George really funded a lot of crazy technology back in the day that really paid off to build what Industrial Light and Magic and Skywalker Sound are. And Kathy Kennedy is continuing that, and Disney is continuing that with these groups to just be able to get entertainment out to people in new and different ways. And Star Wars is certainly something to use as a tool to do that, because it's so vast and so universally well liked so far. So good.
Yes, knock wood. You only got about 40.
Yeah, sign out.
Sign
out
for whatever.
Right. 40. I know. What is it? Yeah. What is it? 40 years now.
45 now.
45 now.
Summer, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Sounds right. And what about Mubo in Tales from the Galaxy's Edge?
Oh yeah, Mubo. So there's sort of the droid. He runs the droid depot at Galaxy's Edge. The story is that, you know, the droid depot there where you can create your own droids there. Mubo is part of that. And so they wanted. I did some voices for Disney Parks for the Mubo character. And then when we wanted to do the interactive experience, I came in and did that. And so he puts you out on adventures to go help, you know, him bring stuff back to this for his to be worked on. And at the same time, you're trying to evade the First Order. And there's also sections of the game where you're being trained as a Jedi. And you meet up with Yoda, and I got to work with Frank Oz again, and he came back to do Yoda, which was amazing. Anthony Daniels did C-3PO, so it was a great cast and more. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure.
Like the Forrest Gump of Star Wars.
What was that?
I said you're like the Forrest Gump of Star Wars. All your just on all these at least from my side, you know, all these great names, right? And add you to that list.
Yeah, it's been I've loved being able to work with the original actors, and then also I worked, you know, I had a relationship with J.J. Abrams because I had done the Star Trek films with him. So when he came on to do the sequels, it was a natural sort of bridge for me to do those. And I'm working with Rian Johnson since Last Jedi, and I've done the Knives Out movies with him. We just finished up the sequel to that one, but it's just, yeah, Star Wars, I make a lot of great connections with people through this company and with Star Wars and you know, forge relationships with filmmakers. I hope that'll last forever, because it's Star Wars is a good icebreaker. It's a good, you know, it joins people together. Usually when I'm staffing a team of sound folks, I usually get a lot of the cream of the crop that want to work with us, and they have a passion for it that extends well beyond a normal project. And you're getting that same feeling that I have, which is it's bigger than any one person. And we're all trying to contribute to something that is going to be entertaining for people. And it's going to be meaningful for people. That's our sort of main goal when we make the shows, you know. It's born out of, you know, our original maker of the show, George Lucas, and I just try to continue that ethos into what we make now.
All right. Star Wars that I faxed my resume to?
Yeah, the fax resume I do. 555. No. I'm sure we have a fax machine somewhere. We might have a fax machine somewhere on in a closet somewhere. I'm not sure where that, maybe there's just, this resume is going to it that I haven't seen. I should go try to look it up.
Right. So I was going to say Star Wars is like the Force. It surrounds us. It binds us together.
Yeah.
Everyone together. Yeah.
I feel that. I totally feel that. And I'm so happy that also we can still work at Skywalker Ranch, which, you know, George, when he, you know, changed his interest in maybe doing his museum and getting out of the sort of filmmaker business on a day-to-day basis, he could have closed the doors to Skywalker and that could have been the end of the legacy, but he's left us open at Skywalker. We're working at Skywalker Ranch where the original movies were done, and that really permeates into the work that we do, and it's a very fortunate thing that he's kept us going like that. And then the legacy of, you know, he could have sold it off as an intellectual property that wasn't connected to the actual people. And he didn't do that. He gave us to, you know, Disney has taken us on, and the actual people that made the original films are part of making these new films. And it's about the people making it, which is a huge part of the appeal of working with people like George Lucas, where they look at that. They don't separate the people from the intellectual property, and it's all cared for by the actual people that make it. So that feels good too.
Yeah, that's what I like to hear.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're probably have taken up enough of your afternoon, but Jimmy, I know you've got at least one more question for that.
Well, I do. Let me bring this Star Destroyer in for a landing with this last question here. When I was a little guy, I used to have to get up early, beat my brother to the couch on Saturday mornings to get the good spot in front of the TV, right? Yeah. But I'd have to get up even earlier than that to beat my parents into the kitchen so I could pour myself a big bowl of sugary goodness. So Matthew, I'd like to know, what was your favorite bowl of Saturday morning cereal and what cartoons did you watch?
Saturday morning cereal. Let's see. It's funny. We only got the really sugary stuff when we were on like a trip. When we went on a car trip, we would get the little like multi-boxed cereal where you could like, you know, and I didn't even know you could do this, but you like cut the box down the middle and open it up and pour milk into the actual box.
Right.
A little wax paper in there. But we got those like when we were traveling around. But I think my one that I honestly, I would, Life cereal. I liked Life cereal. Just the Life. I don't know if that was the one. I know it was kind of boring. That was the one I had like when I was living at home. But like if we're out on the road, I would say Honeycomb. Or what was the one that was like the Pops, was there what called Pops? There was like it was like a yellow
Kix, but I know the one you're talking
about. Sugar pops. Yeah, sugar pops. I dug the sugar pops around on the road. And then definitely Saturday mornings, I mean, Warner Brothers cartoons were, you know, the Bugs Bunny stuff was certainly one of my faves. I mean, the Barber of Seville, that's like that's one of my favorites. I mean, I love watching Saturday morning cartoons.
Deep classics there.
I have a brother and a sister, so we certainly all sat on the couch doing that on Saturdays.
Yeah, we used to go on those long trips too, my family and I, and get those little boxes. And we thought, oh, what a major revelation in technology. You could eat it right under the box, but it never really worked. Like, you just spill a little of the milk over in the box, pull that apart.
I know. My dad, they're cutting them with a knife trying to get it.
Right, that's so funny. What a great memory.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for your time, man. It's an absolute delight to talk to you and spend a little bit of your afternoon with us. Thank you so much.
And whenever you're ready to reveal to the world what that scream is that you're using, please think of us first.
Okay, I will. Yes, Saturday new cereal. I will definitely think of that. Yes.
Oh, right on. Thank you so much for having you do, Matthew.
Great to meet you.
May the force be with you. Thanks a lot.
And with you.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Certainly.
Howdy. Aww. I'm Big Yellow, and I'm so wild about Kellogg's Sugar Corn Pops, I'll trade my Big Yellow bird for a bowl of those Big Yellow Pops.
No.
Trade me that Big Yellow taste for my Big Yellow cone.
No.
My golf clubs, my car keys. Hold on. What do I need to eat a bowl of those Big Yellow Pops?
A spoon.
Got one. Kellogg's Sugar Corn Pop Cereal, plus toast, juice, milk, and spread, is a smart start to your day. Kellogg's Sugar Corn Pops. Those Big Yellow Pops are tops.
Oh, you like that?
It was Sugar Corn Pops.
Sugar Corn Pops.
We were close. We were close. But it's almost like a play on popcorn, which I don't think I ever got when I was a kid.
Well, they actually kind of look like those kernels. I think they actually look, they're actually shaped like little kernels. I think that's kind of what you're supposed to, that's the imagery that you're supposed to get from the yellow.
Very much like corn that isn't popped.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's dumb. All right. Well, I hate rewriting my own history. So, great interview. Matthew Wood, big deal. Big deal.
Oh, my God. You guys.
Did you hear him when he was doing like droid voices?
Oh, my God. You guys. He did Grievous for you. He did the droids for you.
He did the Wilhelm scream for him.
He did two of them. He did two Wilhelm screams.
I got to. I only consider that second one the real one.
I know, me too.
May the force be with you out of them from a big Star Wars. Yeah. That's a pretty big deal for me.
And just a quick little comment on his cereal choice. Sugar Corn Pops are a fantastic cereal. We didn't get it all the time, but that's a memorable cereal. It's a quality cereal. It's got a lot of sugar in it. It's got, corn, whatnot. Great cereal choice. This guy's an ace. This guy's a top 10 guest of all time.
You're saying we're going to have him back?
I don't. Why? You guys just talked to him for like a half hour. We just riddled off a series of wonderful things that he said. There's no way you'll ever get a better interview out of Matthew Wood, who is the heir apparent to Ben Burtt, Oscar-winning sound designer for all the movies that we love. And here he is, the voice of General Grievous.
I still want to know about that new Wilhelm scream that he's talking about.
Yeah.
Quite
frankly, he's kind of a teasing motherfucker. I don't think we're ever going to get a straight answer out of him. So maybe it is best we let it lie.
Well, that's the one thing. If let's say that we're...
Surely we're not going to give up that easily on that.
We'll get to it. But if I was ever in a hotel bar with Matthew Wood, I would get into it with him about this Wilhelm scream.
Would you?
Because I would. Because, every single Star Wars movie has a Wilhelm scream in it, except when he took over. Okay? So, and I just think it should be in there, the original Wilhelm scream, and I don't know why he ever took it out. I know he's trying to make his own. I get it. And that's awesome. I can't wait to identify it. But the fact that we don't know what he's talking about yet means he should have kept the original in there, at least for the Star Wars, at least for the Skywalker related movies. If you want to leave it out of Rogue One, go ahead. But
Marky, I shudder to suggest it, but maybe you should go back and rewatch these movies again.
I rewatch them all the time, and I can't figure out what he's talking about.
There's got to be a similar scream in all of them. So all you got to do is isolate that, and you will track it down.
I bet it's somehow Star Wars related. I bet it's an Obi-Wan.
The clue he gave us was it is related to LucasArts. So very broad, and also doesn't sound like it was originally in a LucasArts movie, but LucasArts also includes so much. But see, now I'm thinking whatever movie serial that Indiana Jones was based on maybe had a scream in it, and that's what we should see. Something related to LucasArts.
You know what? I am so looking out. I am on a bounty hunter mission to find out what the hell he's talking. I want to know what scream he is doing. And I have to pay more attention. That's all.
He did say that when he's ready to tell the world, he would call us.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Yeah.
But it's much more likely you and I are going to learn when we read on Variety the next day, just like everybody else.
But maybe you'll hear it here first.
Maybe.
And that's not a promise, listeners.
But yes, you guys
not take wonderful. That to the bank.
No, that check will not cash. But yeah, you guys, that was a wonderful interview. And, you know, like where I first kind of got, like where I first knew about that name, Matthew Wood, was really from his voice work as General Grievous. And you guys talked about it a little bit with him. But that is such a big character. It is such a huge character, such an amazing character and a fun character in the Star Wars lore. And that's really him. That's really him that did it. And the little tease he did for you without any of the electronics and the mixing and all that, you could hear that's him. That's Grievous right there. And I mean, that's just a big deal.
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue with you, man, but
I mean, yeah,
another day in the life, Dan Grimshay.
Oh, and Jimmy.
And also my sidekick Jimmy's off there.
Well, you guys were there.
I'll take
him.
Second,
I mean,
Billy.
Have you watched a Star Wars movie or show that and since then that you've thought about?
I'm looking for this. Well,
yeah.
I think about Matthew time. Wood every day.
I wake up with it.
Well, the last time I watched the last Star Wars movie, the only screams I remember were my own.
Which movie was this?
The Disgrace of the Jedi, or what the hell was it? You know.
So I may have uncovered another clue. He mentioned he's working on a movie.
Yeah.
He can't even tell us what movie he was working on. That was
last year.
This interview was a few months ago, right?
Yeah.
And so the only movie that on IMDb that he's attached to since Obi-Wan came out, and that was sort of the last thing that was on our agenda to talk to him about, is Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania.
Okay.
So now one of us is going to have to sit through that pile of shit and see if they recognize a scream. First of all, not it. And,
I'll take that one for the team.
All right.
What can I say? I love me some Paul Rudd.
Wait, is it streaming for free on Disney yet? Maybe you could.
Well, that's when I'll do it.
Yeah.
Who? Yeah.
Okay.
I'll definitely watch it.
Paul Rudd, I know you're listening. Please, I apologize. Please come on the show and, allow us to apologize in person. I know you did.
Yeah. I was doing a similar thing where I'm kind of looking through his credits here. And I'm like, I wonder what the hell he's talking about. And like, I watch Star Wars movies all the time since, and a lot of them, he has sound mixed and I cannot isolate. I remember one in, Rogue One. There's like, where they get jumped in, Jeddah, like they're, you know, they're like in that town, the one with that's kind of up like in the mesa, like in the cliff, you know? And I remember like a scream kind of thing. And I wonder if that's what he's talking about, but like, I can't isolate a theme, like a repetitive scream. And I don't know if that's the genius I should be recognizing, is that I don't know when it is, or if I'm just, I don't know if I'm missing something. I don't get what he's doing here. And
well,
what are the great mysteries, you know?
I endeavor to keep it a mystery, so I'm not going to tell anyone what it is. But it took about 4 seconds for me on Google right now.
You found it?
Yeah, but as promised, I'm not going to say a word. I will let each of you ask me one question.
Is it in Rogue One?
Answer.
Oh, okay.
Again, not going to answer. But Jimmy, would you like to waste a question?
I'll burn my question. What LucasArts project is it attached to?
Like, what is it in or what is it from?
What is it from?
I said one question. All right. Moving on.
I was just clarifying my question.
Your Honor.
Your Honor. If this is truly a jury of my peers.
No, speaking
early, we're not going to move on before.
I thought I could stop you, but no, like a bulldozer.
Nay.
It's a Kool-Aid man with a bad pun. There's Jimmy again. We're talking about screens. You know what you hear screens with? Those damn mirrors. You know what else you use your ears for? To hear composers of music.
Composers of music. I love that. Yes. Composers of just to finish off our
music.
To finish off our May or may not be May the 4th.
Maybe the 4th.
That is not bad at all.
Yeah. Both Johnny Heck and I sat down with Joseph Shirley at WonderCon 2023. The Johnny Heck who couldn't make it today because it's his birthday.
That's fair. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to Johnny.
Johnny, I know you're listening, Johnny. Happy birthday, buddy.
So Joseph Shirley is the composer for the most recent season of The Mandalorian. And I know how you guys are. I know a lot of you sharp-eared fans of this show are like, hey, what do you mean Joseph Shirley is the composer of The Mandalorian? That doesn't make any sense. Everybody knows that it's I can never say this guy's name. Gorenson, I believe. It's got the little umlauts. Anytime you got umlauts in a name, it's going to throw me off. Gorenson did the main themes of The Mandalorian. And like season one and season two, it was all of his music, like the, you know, the kind of whistling kind of sound whenever The Mandalorian does something. That's all Gorenson, right?
All that little
Morricone stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's all him.
Spaghetti Western sounds, yeah.
Yeah, so he does like all the like the big themes of The Mandalorian. But when it comes to the actual composing of the episodes and all the action and all that, it's our guest right now. Joseph Shirley is the guy that comes in and steps in and kind of makes all that sound, makes all that music happen when it needs to happen for the episodes. So he is credited as the composer on and themes by Ludwig Göransson. So if you guys watch in this last season of The Mandalorian, just stay, when you're looking at all the concept art, you're going to see themes by Ludwig Göransson, music composed by Joseph Shirley. So there's different kind of credits associated with it, but this is the guy that did all of that. And he also is responsible for the music for the Book of Boba Fett. He was the composer for that also, working with themes based off of Göransson. Most recently he did the Creed 3 album, but you know, you guys all have IMDb at your fingertips. You guys can check out his credits, but this was a very fun interview that we did. It was a one-on-one type of situation. We got to sit with him. We just had a great time. So I would love for you guys to hear this to make up for our may or may not be May the 4th episode.
Magic energy machine.
Yeah. That's
surely you've got this queued up. Of course. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, my name is Mark. This is Paris.
Nice to meet you guys.
It's Saturday Morning Serial. We celebrate the theme of Saturday Morning TV that we not only grew up with.
Yeah.
We're probably a lot older than you are, but we grew up watching Saturday mornings like the Ewoks cartoon, droids, even when I was little, football. But yeah, Star Wars has been a big deal. Gosh, several times.
It still is.
And the whole garage.
Yeah.
You're working on the mail away. And I saw your name of credits last episode.
Yeah.
What does it feel like?
It feels amazing, man. I mean, I echo your enthusiasm and love for this franchise. You know, I mean, I, as a kid, was crazy about it. You know, watched the movies just over and over. And would go to the, you know, I collected the old 1977 action figures. And it was like, I was a big collector back in the day. I loved baseball cards. And I loved collecting these action figures, but we would go to this flea market I'm from Mississippi. We go to the flea market there, and this one lady always had the old school 1977, like original release action figures. And I was like, I don't want it if it doesn't say 1977 on the back, you know, that I was just so crazy about having the original. So yeah, I had a collection. They're actually still in my studio now, kind of watching over my work, you know, giving me their blessing. I just love the whole franchise and have for so long. So I agree with that for sure.
Well, and now that you're working with, did you learn how to say Gorgensen?
I'm mispronouncing, but I do say Gorgensen, but I think he would pronounce it slightly differently, and I haven't mastered that.
I mean, it's got the vowels.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So he's gone along, and obviously I've seen his name pop up in these other movies and things like
that.
Yep. He's obviously very good. And he obviously defined that kind of fluty kind of sound of The Mandalorian. So, you know, based off of that, like, where do you take that and how do you fit in? Because I believe your actual credit is you do the score.
Right.
So what's the difference between what he does and then what you
do? Well, Ludwig is just such a phenomenal composer, and the themes that he contributed to The Mandalorian, like, are already iconic. Like, they were iconic as soon as it went up, you know, the first episode went up. And those flutes that you're hearing are recorders. You know, it's like the instrument that we all played in, like, elementary school.
The first one we learned.
Yeah, exactly. But you can get any different size of them. So a lot of that was, like, a bass recorder. It's a really large recorder instrument. And anyway, he just wrote some amazing themes. And what, you know, how our jobs relate on this season now, the arrangement is really, like, I get to use those themes and score the show. You know, so and they wanted it to feel like the through line. They wanted to feel the through line of season 3 stemming from season 2, which stemmed from season 1. And I had assisted Ludwig at first, and then we, you know, progressed into a more creative relationship over the years. And so I was with him on season 1 and season 2. Season 2 I was actually doing additional music. So it just sort of organically grew from there, and he's just been such a great collaborator and friend and mentor. I mean, I call him about issues or problems, you know, or even just advice, you know. I mean, he's a great guy. So I feel very grateful and fortunate to be able to work with him and with his music for this season. Yep.
So do you, like, take his arrangements or whatever and just kind of reapply them? Or, like, do you have musicians? Like, do you bring in all of that, or is it just kind of in a computer and you just kind of put it all back in?
No. Like, we record every single episode. So whether you're hearing, like, the straight up Mandalorian theme as it was originally written, or you're hearing an arrangement of that, or, you know, a variation, or you're hearing a new theme, like, that's all music that I've put together and we're recording with an orchestra. So, I mean, and we always had a big orchestra for these shows, but we had a slightly bigger orchestra for this season because it's a little bit more robust in a lot of the ways that the different Mandalorian sects and clans are coming together and working together or fighting, you know. So, like, it's always re-recorded and made and resampled sounds that you're hearing, but I'm quoting, you know, some of those themes in my own writing.
You know, it's crazy about the different themes. As the show goes to different planets, if there isn't even way the Mandalorian's not there. It's like, okay, like the previous episode, plus the one before where the Coruscant, it's got like a little spy gate.
Yeah.
So currently watching the footage of the maybe collaborating, or please tell us, what's that? Are you watching the footage and then coming up with the Infinity Sultan, you want to take it?
Yeah. The editors on these shows just do such a brilliant job, and they're constantly working with John and Dave and Rick about how to tell the story, you know, how to lay this out. But while they're editing, we're feeding them music, and is sort of helping tell the story that they want to tell, you know. But it always goes through John and Dave and Rick. Like, it, you know, their vision for the show is very strong, but they give you enough space to feel creative and help support their vision in certain ways, and it's just such a joy to see that process, because, like, honestly, the show's kind of come to life after it gets the treatment of, I mean, I'm saying this as a composer, but, like, so I'm biased, but, like, I do think what they are presenting to me, you know, their first edit of the episode, it begins to start to come to life a little bit more once I'm able to score it, you know, and then actually give it that sort of touch. And they give you that space, and they're just very clever people,
very smart people.
set.
And also, folks, our fan question, how often do you jump on the set? Take a look here.
I've been to the volume once.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was just an insane, it is just like the craziest room you've ever stepped into, you know, like the technical feat that room is like, I don't understand it. I'm not geared that way, but like it was a mind blowing experience, you know, and everybody at Lucasfilm they figured out a system that feels so innovative and new, but also like we're still talking about Star Wars, it still supports the legacy of that sort of worn-in futuristic thing that Star Wars is sort of known for. It's really incredible, you know. It's really incredible. And
so we just watched the fourth episode.
Yeah,
this is the one where they go to Coruscant. I've only seen it twice so far. It goes by so fast. It goes by so fast. Did you pull in some of John Williams' music from episode one, episode two, when you were doing that, those
quite the flashback?
Yeah,
with Ahmed.
Yeah, when they were there with.
The way that flashback begins, it's Grogu's, you know, flashback. It's picking up from where we left off with the Book of Boba Fett, right? So like. What I decided to do is to bring the audience back into that same flashback with the same music that I wrote for the Book of Boba Fett as when he was with Luke and first went there. And you only get a taste of it there, you know, in the Book of Boba Fett, but now we get to see the rest of the story. I think that music is kind of built out of, like, some of the language that John Williams is known for and the language, the musical heritage of Star Wars. While I wasn't quite quoting direct, you know, themes of his, it definitely, it feels like in the same wheelhouse, and that's like my favorite music of all time.
Yeah.
So and it's music that I've cherished my entire life. So I feel very close to it, as we all do. You know, you feel these are like, it's like putting on a warm blanket. It's like, it feels nice to be in the Star Wars universe and feel that sort of musical language to accompany it, while we were trying to do something like slightly different. And, you know, we're meeting new characters, we're learning more about Grogu and like how he made it out of the Order 66. I mean, it was such a beautifully shot and like directed scene, I would say, that I just wanted to honor the past. You know, I really wanted to honor the past and then, you know, build our own type of language in with it, you know? So, I mean, there's new synths that are sort of in that scene and a different percussion that maybe you wouldn't catch in the feature film length, you know, type of project or score from other composers, you know? So, I just had so much fun with that, trying to, like, link and connect dots, you know?
Well, there's been a lot of the Star Wars fan base, just the man.
Yes.
One of the things that I do not agree with this at all is that having the Mandalorian get back together with Grogu in the Book of Boba Fett,
yes,
how that should have been saved for the Mandalorians. Again, I do not agree with that. I like what they did with it.
Okay.
But, and you just alluded to some of the themes that you brought over from the Book of Boba Fett,
right,
to it. I am of the opinion that it's just basically the same story. It's just, it kind of talks about Boba Fett for a little while.
But that's all about the Mandalorian.
Yeah.
Kids, if you don't mind speaking on the themes of the music, because you did work on both.
Yeah.
If I'm right, is it really just kind of the same story, just even just musically?
I mean, that's a really great argument you're making. I think it all feels like it's happening around the same time or dealing with some of the same situations, the character. You know, to me, it feels like it's part of the same overarching story. Like, whereas when you watch a show like Andor, which was brilliant, that feels like a totally different tone and a different aesthetic, and it was really well done, you know. But, like, our shows have been a little bit more orchestral and a little bit more like classically Star Wars, while also sort of like, I don't know, John has always said techie, you know, we've always like introduced some funky, quirky synths and weird percussion, you know. So I think if you're noticing, it's probably because like Ludwig and I have both worked on these shows for, you know, several years now, and we have sort of developed the sound over time, and like oftentimes I'm quoting like Ludwig's sound in certain ways, you know. So like, it is, it feels sort of all part of the same family. And we're kind of on one, you know, we're telling one overarching story with all these side, you know.
And it's all in music, right?
It is, yeah, yeah. You will hear, yeah, you'll hear moments where I quote the Book of Boba Fett, or, you know, it's like season two, we meet Bo-Katan, up quoting her theme later on in the season. You know, it's like, we're trying to, like, that's part of world building. You know, you're informing what came before by supporting what is happening on screen at that time, you know, and you're pushing a character along through the story and trying to do your best to help tell the same story, you know?
What, one of my favorite things to happen on a Disney Plus live action Star Wars,
yes,
is that second episode of Book of Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And he becomes a Tusken Raider.
Yeah.
And they close on that dance.
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool, right?
Or did you fall and that music?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. I wrote that.
Where, why so much percussion? Like, what kind of inspired, again, it's one of my favorite moments in the last, really? 20 years.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
And it worked because of that music.
Yeah, yeah.
It touched, it's just so, and it worked, you know, there's a lot of natives in the Awa family.
Okay.
Like where we,
yeah, yeah.
I'm sitting sweet. I really connected to that. Oh,
yeah.
Did that creep in, you know, did like the story of America creep in? Like what was it about that moment? Why do I like it so
much? Well, it's like, it's hitting on, I agree that that's a special, special moment. I mean, it does hit on certain tropes of, like, the Western idea, the Western concept. When you think of old Westerns, like, I don't think they were trying to be as direct with it. It's just my own read on it. But, like, you know, you think of a cowboy meeting a Native American, and, like, the cultures are so different and so distant from each other. But there are times where they come together and they begin to work together, you know? I mean, that was kind of like that moment where Boba Fett was accepted to be as part of that tribe was really, really powerful in that sort of way, because we're already familiar with that archetype, I think, you know? And so, but musically, I was, you know, it was definitely, you know, it was definitely something that John wanted to sort of highlight, is like, this feels like a tribal ceremony. This is a religious experience. This is like, you know, it's a ceremonial, you know, brotherhood and sisterhood moment between these tribes coming together. And so we went super tribal with it musically. And I recorded a ton of percussion for that. I mean, we had some brilliant percussionists play on that moment. And then we've got didgeridoos playing. We put the orchestra on top. I mean, it was a whole hodgepodge.
Did you have the dancing before the music, or the music did get the choreography going?
They had the dancing. That is how they you know, shot it in that way. What was tricky, the challenge of that thing, was finding like the tempo that would really match that and feel like we're pushing to the end of that episode. Like it was definitely like the shape of that cue was something that John really, really wanted to get right. And all credit to him, like he took a lot of what I had written and, you know, pieced it together in a certain way, like on the dub stage. Like he knows how music can work in a show, for sure, you know.
Did you know, or did you have the music they were dancing to?
No, I wish I'd, because that would have been easier to figure out what tempo they were, you know.
What if it was like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Shakira.
Yeah,
okay, but what,
right? Yeah,
it was really, again, it was really something. It was a powerful moment. You know, it's just one of those like peaks, you know, it just really shined. That, you know, when that's your second episode,
yeah,
it's going to be hard to live up.
That you know, that was a hell of an episode.
It was a hell of an episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, but good thing about that episode is that, like, I was good. Everything that came after that, this is the,
that's great.
The book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It had reverence, and it's just this incredible moment for him.
Right.
You know, it was really touching. For those of us kids that thought that, kind of got the short shaft. You know,
yeah, yeah.
I did with the jet nod.
Right.
So,
right.
My gosh, what a moment. So congratulations for being a part.
Thank
of
you.
We'd like to thank you again for taking the time.
Of course.
Of course. Out with us today.
Yes.
We know you have to go. Do you have a final question for this?
I just actually a statement. Yeah. Over so that there's very few shows that, you know, certainly very few, where every episode I listened to the music throughout the whole credit.
Yeah.
And I think that's a testament to how Stubrad's it all is. And I will say this, from episode one, maybe Hewitt as well, as soon as Din Djarin nails that guy, you hear that.
The record is asked.
That's when I do it. What about you when you watch the final product? Is that, when did you know this was?
I knew it. I mean, Ludwig had, I was his assistant at the time. This would have been the end of 2016, I think. He booked out a studio like where we were working at the time for a month, just a straight up month, and started just compiling ideas, you know, making songs. So like the minute he played me that the Mandalorian theme, which was not orchestrated at the time, obviously, you know, he was playing piano, he's playing his recorders, like, I knew it was special the first time I heard it, like, as we all did, I think, you know, it's just like, when you have something good, you know it's good the minute it starts, you press play. So, I mean, all hats off to Ludwig, you know, for just writing an amazing theme, and that's why we all stick around for the end credits, you know, we want to hear it again.
And they also do the little...
The artwork. Oh, it's so cool. They've seen the concept art that went into that episode, and it reminds you of all the moments that you've just seen. You know, it's so cool.
And how close it is, how, you know, it all comes to that creative spirit of how it translates so well. It's one of the coolest little...
I think so, for sure.
And also, it kind of makes us stick around and see the names, too.
Yeah.
I saw it because I...
So great.
That's the guy we're going to meet him.
Yeah.
It was neat. It was such a moment. So, congratulations again.
Thank you.
Career.
Appreciate it, guys.
I'll be looking for that name.
All right. Nice to meet you guys. Y'all take it easy. Yes. Bye. Have a good one.
Come on, you guys. Only a little.
Hungry for a big honey dash.
Big days, honeycomb, big days.
Honeycomb days, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not small.
Andre the Giant.
R.I.P. Andre the Giant.
Yes. Always so hungry, he would steal from children.
I figure since we had such giant guests in our giant show, let's do a giant honeycomb commercial to kind of seal it all, sweeten it all out, make it all just right.
You nailed it.
Did I?
Before, that's a pretty big statement,
Mark.
Played it, I thought, you know, it'd be great here. Some kind of Andre the Giant breakfast cereal commercial. And then boom, there you were, like a genie.
I know. I did it again. I'm the producer that gets it done. And here we are. So, yeah, guys, thanks again for all of this. We just had two mega guests. Obviously, Matthew Wood. I'm just a huge, huge, huge fan of his work. Joseph Shirley. I mean, it was an honor to meet him. This guy has just got, I mean, this guy's career, even though he's already accomplished so much, he's just, this guy's going places, man. And so keep an eye out for him. The Mandalorian season 3 is in the can. It was a wonderful season.
It was.
Yeah.
I know because it's the internet, I felt the need to take a shit on it, but I loved it.
Exactly.
Marky, before we get too far away, tip of the cap to you for your conversation and interview skills there at the old round table.
Thank you. Yeah.
And you always try to play it down like you're not good at it. And, you know, a lot of people would agree with you, but this time you really did a good job.
Marky.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
It's never too late to go to medical school.
Yeah.
Just wanted to say that, because clearly this won't be the last time we play one of your interviews.
Johnny Eck was there, you know, he's the best, Johnny is the best roundtable interviewer I've ever sat next to, but I did kind of hog this one because I absolutely love, and you guys could hear it in that sound, is that I absolutely love, I think of over the last, since the Disney era started, one of my most favorite things of all of Star Wars is that episode 2 of Book of Boba Fett. You know, I don't know if you guys remember, but it's the one with the Tusken Raider dance, you know, that Boba does. And Joseph Shirley did the music for that scene. And it was just great to be able to talk to the guy that composed that scene, that delivered the music for that particular scene.
Here's a question that obviously you didn't get to, but you know, maybe next time you can, Doctor. Wouldn't that be considered cultural appropriation?
Of what?
I mean, Joseph Shirley is not a Tusken Raider.
I guess so.
He writes their traditional music. It's a little entitled.
Well, we really don't know if Joseph Shirley is or isn't a Tusken Raider.
I mean, they're always wearing the things, so he could be. We have no idea.
When you were talking to him, did he grab the microphone and hold it over his head, rock it back and forth?
You know what? That is a gross stereotype as well.
Yeah, you're right.
You're right. I think we are not on the right side of history here, boys.
You guys, any last-minute Star Wars thoughts? What are you guys looking for? What are you guys looking forward to in the year 2023, 2024, and 2025 Star Wars?
I am looking forward to the announcement that Rian Johnson will remake all of every single one of the Star Wars movies ever made.
Okay. Jimmy?
I am looking forward to the reveal of who is really Darth Vader.
Ah, okay.
Did I miss it?
I want to see if that Emperor ever gets his comeuppance.
Somehow,
yeah, he's got it coming to him.
Who does? That's fun of a bitch.
I mean, if there's ever some dude as you get thrown down like a mile deep shaft, that's the one.
Well, thank you. Yes, my answer to that question is that they had just announced that they're going to do.
That's all the time we got, folks. Thanks for tuning in to Saturday Morning Serial.
For this.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
Oh, this is enough of this.